You are listening to Viva and Barnes, Law for the People. I am Viva Fry, David Fryheit, a Montreal litigator turned YouTuber. Robert Barnes is a world-renowned American civil rights attorney. In each podcast, we are going to break down and explain things that are going on in the legal world around us in terms that can be understood by everyone. The audio is pulled directly from our weekly live streams on YouTube, where you can find us on my channel, Viva Fry. And although the audio is not perfect when it comes to knowledge, knowledge is more important than audio quality. Enjoy your podcast. The Hunter Biden emails have been verified by others on the email threads, and the Bidens have not denied they are hunters. Okay, first, this is our first topic. It's going to have like subcategories. What the heck? So where do we even start with this? I think we should start with, I don't want to get too far into the substance of the emails because they're not verified in a technical sense. It didn't come from WikiLeaks. But let's just, if we go over the overview, the glossing over, 30,000 foot overview of what's allegedly in those emails, what they allegedly show, before we get into the legal questions.
Sure. So there's multiple layers of context here. And so the question is where to start with context. We'll start with the granular and then move up to the global. On the granular side, a laptop that is reported to be Hunter Biden's laptop, a copy of that laptop was turned over by a repairman in Delaware to Rudy Giuliani, who then apparently let Steve Bannon know about its existence. And that in turn led Steve Bannon to apprise the New York Post of its existence. And ultimately, the contents of that, or at least partial contents of the copies of that laptop were provided to the New York Post. The New York Post took efforts to validate it, and there was a threefold effort. One, to talk to the repairman about how he came in its possession. Secondly, to look at other information on the laptop and see whether it contained information that could only be or likely be Hunter Biden's laptop. And third, cross-check it against other public information that they were aware of or knew. And all three came back with independent acts of confirmation that it was Hunter Biden's laptop, Hunter Biden's emails, Hunter Biden's text messages.
First question. I mean, this is the first question I had. Why on earth does the repairman even think of going to Giuliani?
So three things happen. The first thing is, this is what happens when the key corrupt member of your family that's a key conduit for corruption is a crack addict. Things go AWOL. You can't trust them, unfortunately, to not do something incredibly incompetent. I think I got the French right.
Close enough.
Okay. All right. Yeah. You say it better. I'm trying to make it sound like incompetent. The French version of it just sounds so worse. It sounds so, oh, that's terrible.
That was from a movie. You are what the French call les incompetents. I think it was Home Alone 1, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's a great reference. And our first cinematic reference comes from you. So that's problem one. How it happened, problem two is the repairman gets nervous because Hunter never comes back for it. Now, the way repairmen operate is they want collateral for doing the work on your computer or anything else. So you sign a contract that says, hey, if I do all the work and fix your computer and you never come back, I'm like a pawn shop. I get to keep the computer. And I get to resell it or do whatever I want with it. And that reaches area number three for folks out there. You'd have no expectation of privacy in anything you abandon. So this is why, for example, your garbage is the number one source of cops and private investigators going through it. So I've hired people to go through folks' garbage. People keep forgetting. They think, hey, if I throw something away, it's still mine, even though I'm putting it out to the public to be put into a public place somewhere. And that's why they don't shred things, which you should do before you put it in the garbage. Things like that, you'd be surprised at the things people leave in their garbage. So they really telltale signs. Sometimes the notes of their bad activities, it's like a live show of Darwin Award winners for dumb criminals. That's effectively what happened with Hunter Biden. So legally, the reason why he could look at it is both his contract and privacy law entitled him to do so once Hunter Biden never came back for it. And importantly, never paid for the work that was done. It would have been a different thing if he would have paid for the work but not come back for it. What happened?
Actually, And if I just stop you there now, Karen Stratton says, apparently the laptop was sent to the FBI in fall, winter of last year, which is interesting and material. But so that was the first question I had. We know the principles in law. If you do work on a car, the person doesn't pay, you can seize the car, or you don't have to give the car back until they pay, and you can use the car as some form of payment. When it came to a computer, I was sort of maybe thinking you could keep the computer, but you have to wipe the information because you don't have the right or access to the information on it. But if the idea is that you don't have a right to privacy in anything you abandon, that is fascinating.
Exactly. It's just like what you put in your garbage. Same thing. Because I've run into this problem. I had a client who left his laptop at a pawn shop, never went back for it, ended up in the Fed's possession. It was a big, big problem. It turned out there were other issues. So I've been through it. So I've been through the legal weeds on it. And that's why it is what it is. But that leads to the second component. The repairman started to get nervous because he recognized Hunter Biden in the news stories. And he started wondering whether maybe this guy deliberately left his laptop here. Maybe I'm sitting on criminal evidence and somebody's going to accuse me of somehow being in the middle of something. He just hit every panic button known to man. So he decided, okay, and this was a smart little repairman. He'd been around long enough, obviously. He does two things. One, he calls the FBI and says, I got this. Please take it off my hands. But he does a second thing. He backs it up. Because he's like, I don't trust, maybe the FBI will even be bad. This is big, powerful political people. I don't want to get on the wrong side of anybody. I'm going to have a little safety. I'm going to have a little insurance. I'm going to do a backup of the laptop. What is fascinating here is the FBI had this information for a year. And apparently, just like Clinton emails, just like Clinton Foundation, they tried to bury it again. They sat on it, pretended it didn't exist, didn't investigate it. They had it while the impeachment investigation was ongoing. It was clearly material evidence to the impeachment, and they failed to disclose it to anybody, failed to provide it to anybody. And what this kid did is he just waited a long time, and then it was towards the election season, and he realized the FBI was not going to do anything with it, and he made the smart play, which is, okay, I don't want to – Biden might win this election. I know things that other people don't know. I don't want to end up, remember folks, Epstein didn't kill himself. Eternal truth number two. Number one, Sally Yates is corrupt. So he decided he didn't want to get Epstein somehow, or Clinton or Arkansas, as they used to say in Arkansas, because a lot of people seem to drop dead, more people than dropped dead around the Kennedy assassination, dropped dead around the Clintons. So the Clinton, the getting close to the Clintons is still a higher risk factor than getting close to someone with COVID, folks. So he was like, I'm now, part of this is speculation, but this is my guess as to what his motivations were. He thought, you know what? I don't want to get in the middle of something if Biden wins. These polls are saying Biden's going to win. I'm going to provide this publicly. So then it's no longer in my hands. Other people have the intel. Other people have the info. Whatever they do, they do with it. But there's no incentive anymore to have me floating in a river in Delaware someday. So,
and the amazing thing is, it's an interesting thought process as well. Is if you don't mirror the drive and you don't have some proof of authenticity of the way it was when you received it or had it, there's no telling who's going to blame the repairman for what magically appeared on that computer after the fact.
And it's already happening. Because as soon as the evidence came out, what came out? The high-ranking same members of the FBI that have been trying to cover up for the Bidens, just like they covered up for the Clintons, said, oh, this was Russian-planted propaganda. So they were already going there. And so he helped protect himself by having a copy. He released to third parties. He turned the originals over to the FBI without doing anything. He put it out so that narrative would be difficult for them to prosecute. But clearly that's what they would have alleged if he didn't have a copy. They would have said, oh, no, that's fake. And this is okay. This came from the Russians and this guy's in the middle of it. I mean, look at what happened to Papadopoulos. He was just a little low level guy. And all of a sudden he's looking at a couple of years in federal prison. He ended up doing a little bit of time, but still had his life ruined. Same thing to Carter Page, largely didn't have to do any time, but had his reputation completely crushed and bye-bye any connections to Russia after he's disclosed as a source for the FBI and the CIA for a decade. So the kid clearly made the right decision. Young guy made the right play, understood how this works. I believe he lived in Delaware, which would make sense because that means he understood some context that most people don't, which is who Joe Biden really is and why Barack Obama really picked him. And it wasn't because of his blue collar appeal.
So, Okay, so I mean, it's it. So first legal question out of the way: abandoned property, no right to privacy. So once this computer's abandoned or seems to be abandoned, apparently the lawyers wanted it back afterwards, but a little too late. You know, he can look and see. He can see what's on it, and once he sees what's on it, he gives it to the FBI. Well, a long time ago, FBI seems to do nothing. For whatever the reason, motivation doesn't matter. Later on, he gives Giuliani and Giuliani's lawyer a copy of the hard drive. Giuliani has now been making his turns on the media to promote what was on that computer. Now, what is the nature of the evidence? What is the evidence in quotes? What's on the computer that is relevant to anything other than you know, what some are saying is a troubled kid?
So, I mean, there's that aspect, but everybody sort of all, mostly I saw that as verification that the emails were in fact Hunter Biden's emails, that there were the kind of photos and videos that only Hunter Biden would have on his laptop, that someone else wouldn't have on Hunter Biden's laptop. Frankly, some of the excuses I heard that this was Russian disinformation and whatnot, I was like, well, that would be worse, because that would mean Russians had this private information about Hunter Biden's reckless habits and past and personal videos and whatnot. That wouldn't be a better situation. That would be what they accused. And this goes back to our original statement throughout the how often projection is confession. And you look at what they accused Flynn of, you look at what they accused Trump of. It's often what they are giving you a roadmap to what they are guilty of. And like, worry about blackmail. Nobody's more blackmailable than the Biden family because of Hunter Biden and his behavior and other factors. But so the key things on there were emails and text, which confirmed information that showed two things. One, Joe Biden's culpable knowledge about what his family was up to in terms of monetizing his office in the as vice president, especially for financial reward for the Biden family. And that included his brother, his sisters, his son, and others, and he himself. The second aspect was the degree to which he was personally involved. That there was that the that he there's references to him as the big guy. There's references to meetings being set up with him directly, involving some of these dubious actors. All of which he had previously denied. Some of which would. And here's another irony: like if you wanted a true FARA case, a Foreign Agents Registration Act criminal case. What Hunter Biden and the Biden family was doing actually is a much more legit FARA case than what they brought against Paul Manafort or what they brought against people connected to Flynn. It tells you again, they're doing what they're accusing others of, and listen to what they accuse others of, because they're almost always confessing. Reverse it and you'll get a confession and you'll know where to look. And somebody smart on that side of the aisle apparently did do that, though they mostly got fortunate. Now, the bigger backstory is Joe Biden comes from the old school Democratic political machine. So when Barack Obama got nominated and won, he did not come from a political machine. He had strong ties to what you could call the intelligence apparatus. There were connections to that as to people can research it. Won't go into great detail here, but there's a reason why he goes from a low-level student at Occidental College to a prestigious graduate of Columbia University with ties to very unique foundations and institutions in New York. All right. So if you track and trace some of those people, you'll find some other connections. But where he did not have connections was to the old school, two parts of the big political, national Democratic political machine. One was just the Clinton political machine, which had built up very strongly. So he gives Hillary the State Department, promises her basically, I think, to become his successor, and turns a blind eye to the Clinton Foundation as long as they keep everything off the books, hence the emails not being kept in the regular course of governmental duty. And at the same time, but the other part of the big political machine is the old school political machine. I used to say that Barack Obama may have learned his ideas in Hawaii and Indonesia and Occidental College, but he learned his politics in Chicago. And in Chicago, the other you make sure you are bartering with the right political connections and the right political machines. Joe Biden had no historic appeal to working class whites in the Midwest. He only had one contested election in his life in 1970. After that, everyone was a breeze. Every time he tried to run for anything outside of that, he got crushed and humiliated twice, 1988 and again in 2008, both Iowa and New Hampshire. So, and again, as it turned out, 2020, both of those states, he's never had unique working class appeal. That was always a bogus narrative that the media pitched. what Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton took care of the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton political machine, but Joe Biden took care of the old school political machine when the Irish used to run things on the Democratic machine side in big cities, especially going back to Tammany Hall. And that political machine, people can watch shows like The Wire. People can watch a great movie about how urban politics work by John Sayles. There's a range of it. You can read books like New Confessions of an Economic Hitman or The Original Confessions of an Economic Hitman and the things like that. And it'll educate you on how the political process works at the grassroots level for Democratic political machines. If you're smart, you don't make the mistake Duncan Hunter made, the Republican congressman who was indicted and convicted in San Diego, who was using campaign funds for his personal benefit. You don't do that. You do like what Ilhan Omar has learned. And like I said, be like the Somalians to quickly pick up the corrupt aspects of American politics, just like it did in Project Veritas. You make sure your campaign funds don't go to you for personal benefit. They go to a friend or family member who then is just charitable and generous with you. The other legalized form of bribery is you get honorarium and speaking fees and consulting fees and board of director fees and book fees after you leave office.
It's actually something I just put up on Twitter yesterday, and I think you retweeted it. Was who was it? It was, I'm going to forget the name of the guy who tweeted, this is how how Joe Biden ended up with this $50 million mansion, whatever, $8 million in book sales. And I said, yeah, that's what you call bribery in advance. It's sort of like, here's $600,000 for a speaking gig for a job well done as president. It makes no sense that anybody's time is worth that much, especially after they leave office, unless, you know, there's some implied, do it for us now and we'll line your pockets later. Actually, one legal question here about all of this. Did the computer repair guy have any legal obligation to report his findings? I don't know how this works. If you find something like, I'm not suggesting this was on Hunter Biden's laptop. If you find illegal content on a laptop doing a repair, do you have to report it to the FBI?
It all depends. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on your right to access that information. It turns on the right to authorized access to the information. So it's at now, once it was abandoned property, there was risk because what happens, for example, let's say he found things that might be child pornography, right? Underage minor sexual activity. Yeah. If that's on there, once it's abandoned, technically that's his. Technically he owns it. Technically he possesses it. That would create legal risk for him. And That's probably what, I'm not going to say that far because that hasn't been confirmed, but I'm saying that could be an explanation for why he went to the FBI.
Okay, so that's the interesting political backdrop. The legal questions then, we now understand the accessing to the computer. He goes to the FBI. FBI does nothing, sits on it. I brought up a super chat that suggested, you know, this was somewhat known within, which is why they rushed the impeachment to get to that before any of this could get out. The speculative stuff I'm less interested in just because we can all have our own opinions. But the ramifications of what's on it potentially show that Joe did not know what his son was up to. If the text that was released the other day tends to show that it was actually Hunter who might have been supporting Big Joe through the gigs that they got hooked up, whatever. Okay, that's the political side. The legal side, once this story breaks and then Twitter, Facebook goes into full panic mode. And what I love is, the narrative now is, we don't know that, you know, this is Russia disinformation. They're altered. They might be altered, et cetera. Same exact pattern that goes on with Hillary Clinton's emails when Donna Brazile got caught up in this. So she says, I'm not confirming that these emails may or may not have been modified or altered. They never were altered. Then, you know, apologizes for the truthfulness of them later on. Twitter goes in, and for everybody who doesn't know this, was not allowing people to share the link to the New York Post expose article breaking the story. Somebody from the New York Post, one of the journalists themselves said, I can't tweet a link to my own story or our own story because Twitter's blocking it. No explanation. They just block it. Facebook as well. Then they come out afterwards and say, we blocked it. The reason why we blocked it is because some of the images contained personal information and it violates some of our policies. They then come out and revise that a little later and say, no, it violates our policies on publishing hacked material, which I also said on Twitter, sort of confirms the veracity of the documents. And now people are coming out and saying, it might be modified and altered, in which case it wouldn't have violated any hacked terms of service use. It would have just been, you know, fake information. So they've gone through the gamut of excuses. But Robert, how does a social media platform justifiably legally or illegally, or is it illegal? How do they go about censoring that without consequence? I mean, people are asking, how do they do it?
Well, it's always helpful when the Ukraine advisor to Biden's campaign and to Joe Biden historically is now the director of fact checking for Facebook in that precise area. So that's where it starts. The second aspect of this is, you know, how does a criminal case like this sort of bust open? The timing for that, the problem when you're trying to set up a, let's say you're trying to monetize Biden's power. And the excuse from Biden was always other people are doing it without his notice or knowledge. He's not culpable. Maybe his family members doing it, but he's not involved. That's what the emails and the texts refute and dispute. But the problem is usually you get in bed with other corrupt criminals. So the other backstory to all of this, and the reason why they were ready for something to fall and ready to suppress it and censor it and try to create a dissident story. I mean, they were quick with the dissident story, quick with censorship, quick with suppression. That usually means
it was the day of. You couldn't share the link to the article, and it was mind blowing. It was mind blowing. Sorry,
it's because they were prepared. They knew this was coming, and the reason why they know this was coming is everybody's known this about Joe Biden for a long time. So to just give people a personal insight, when I was a criminal defense lawyer, people connected to Joe Biden were constantly pitching that for the right donations, they could set up a meeting. And Joe Biden was smart. Nothing in writing, always in cash. These were the terms, okay? These were Joe Biden's allies. I couldn't directly pin Joe Biden for it, but these were people that knew him, were close to him, politically allied to him. I refused to get involved, told my clients, don't get anywhere near this with a 10-foot pole. Didn't trust it at all. But what was being pitched was that for the right donations and the right meeting, maybe the criminal case of a client could go away. So that gives you an idea of how much was being monetized around it. And when Hunter was in debt and deeply involved with billion-dollar deals with Chinese government officials, multi-million-dollar deals with Ukrainian corrupt energy officials, multi-million-dollar deals from what they call in Russia the Moscow Mafia, which people don't know that there's a bunch of political groups that have power. Putin has very little direct power in certain ways. He just tries to keep the corrupt people in check. The Moscow regime is infamously corrupt. When something goes crazy in Russia, it's usually the Moscow regime. It has nothing to do with Putin. But the most corrupt actor in Russia is the widow of the Moscow mayor. You can look into how she became the widow. That's another story. But she had a completely unexplained massive money sent to Hunter Biden. He set up a consulting company, something generic like Rosemont Seneca. It sounded like the Wolf of Wall Street, Stratton Oakmont, which will actually come back into our Section 230 story, ironically enough.
Yeah. I took a picture of that, the super chat that I just brought up from Zippo, because we're going to get into Section 230. So
exactly. So the issue is that anybody who's been around the Bidens and in the Biden political, you know, as soon as he got power, his sister suddenly becomes a political consultant. Do you think she's really a skilled political consultant, folks? It's just ways to funnel money to the family. The brother is doing real estate deals in Iraq. Do you think he had a real estate connection? Research his history. Do you think Hunter Biden suddenly became an expert on Chinese data security or Ukrainian energy? I mean, everybody knew what was going on. And the only question was, could they prove it was tied to Joe? And the reality was Joe was smart. Joe didn't put it in his calendar. It was a great thing. It was the Prince Andrew defense. I double checked. I didn't meet with Epstein that day. It wasn't written in my calendar. Yeah, right. The calendar defense. It's like the Stephen Glass defense when he was
I like the Prince Andrew. Was it Prince Andrew? The defense was, I recall at that period of time in my life, I was unable to sweat. That was one of the defenses that he gave.
He was online. Never a party guy. He doesn't know where that comes from. Party, Prince Andrew. It's fascinating. The Stephen Glass was a famous fake journalist for the New Republic, was writing fake news stories. They actually portray a version of it in the show The Wire.
And another movie reference, Shattered Glass. Great movie.
Great movie. And what it is he would say, look at my notes. Because he made up his story in his notes, journalists were so used to justifying what they reported by whatever nonsense they put in their notes that it became the source, as if that was somehow an independently verifiable source. And as lawyers, we can tell you your diary of events, very rarely admissible because it's, you know, self-serving hearsay. So but that's the nature of it. Sometimes contemporaneous notes can be relevant in certain circumstances.
Yeah. Isaac Castillo asks, has Biden's camp come out and state that the laptop email info are patently false, or are they just pounding the table? They're just dead silent. They haven't said anything.
Correct. And his lawyers have asked for it back. So, by the way, folks, if you're going to pretend something is fake, don't ask for it back. Just word to the wise. I've been through this scenario before. I'm like, I don't know where that came from. That's not my clients. Like I said, they found a laptop of my clients at a pawn shop. And I was like, that's somebody else's. Oh, who knows who borrowed it and took it? And you should look at that pawn shop owner. He's probably a freak. You have to come up with whatever defenses you can. But I'll tell you what I didn't do. I didn't ask for it back. That's what I did not do. I have no doubt that the texts and emails are valid. Everybody, put it this way. There was a reason Biden had his son right behind him when he went to China. Coming off that plane, it was a message to everybody in China: you better start dealing with the kid, and to get what I want, to get my piece of the action. Because the big money for if you're these days in American politics, this is what Confessions of the Economic Hitman are partially about, is, and there's documentaries on it too, is the monetization of foreign sources. This is why the Clinton Foundation was 90% foreign. The biggest places you can get bribed are foreign governments who are completely dependent on what the U.S. does for security, for criminal prosecutions, for military influence, for political control, you name it, particularly in Iraq and Ukraine and China and in parts of Russia. Not all of Russia. Putin basically has shut the door to U.S. influence at a national level, but you can still have influence at the local level, at the Moscow level, at oil companies doing business in Europe, oligarchs doing business in Cyprus and the United States, and other people. Olenikov had a lot of connections here in the United States. So that's who you shake down. And the Biden extended family has done an art form of it. And the money there's emails that are saying that Biden was going to be a secret 10% shareholder of a Chinese company. By the way, most of these people have been criminally prosecuted in their foreign countries. The people he was involved with in Ukraine now being criminally prosecuted. The people Hunter was involved with in China now being criminally prosecuted. Not only that, here's the other way this story backed out. The problem with dealing with when you have this sort of corrupt set of families, aside from one having a derelict kid who's such an addict, he's going to leave his laptop at some local repairman shop. The other problem, and maybe not fully remember, the other problem is you're going to inevitably invite foreign or other corrupt actors around with you. So the other thing that blew up here is his main partner in all of these projects was a guy by the name of Devin Archer, along with John Kerry's stepson from the Heinz family fortune money, as in Heinz ketchup money. And they were the three partners with this project that was basically monetizing access to the vice president, to all these corrupt foreign oligarchs around the world. And they just decided, hey, why stop there? Why not rip off some Indian tribes and some hedge funds here in America? So they're just, it's a problem with dumb, greedy people. Like I said, corruption, okay. Dumb, okay. Both together, not good. And it's the Judge Sullivan disease. So Archer basically got involved, tried to rip off an Indian tribe. They did a bond deal, got control over a hedge fund that had money from an investment fund that had money from pension funds. And that was their problem. They scammed some big rich people in the process, got them to buy the bonds, actually pocketed most of the cash, didn't give it to the tribe. They all go back and read about the Abramoff scandal that implicates Ralph Reed on the Republican side of the aisle. Long history of them ripping off tribes. I've represented a range of tribes in a range of matters, and it's a frequent problem. But again, the part of how that whole deal went down was they were selling their access to Joe Biden. Guess who steps into our story to make sure this criminal case stays cabined? Which district do you think steps in?
I'm going to say, if I have one guess, SDNY.
Even though they weren't in the SDNY, the tribe wasn't in SDNY, the people defrauded aren't in SDNY, but magically, the Southern District of New York and Preet Bharara come to play. And they get the case somehow assigned to Dan Abrams' sister, who's the daughter of Floyd Abrams, whose husband is part of the Mueller special counsel team. So they secure convictions of these guys. Somehow, Hunter Biden is the one who doesn't get touched. Reportedly, he had nothing to do with this somehow. And in fact, the judge, strangely, sets aside the verdict that happened in her own courtroom. But what happened first week of October? This is another reason for timing. First week of October, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals reversed what Judge Abrams did, reinstated the verdict, and it meant Devin Archer and his other comrades were going to prison soon. And apparently they were very unhappy about this fact. So and my guess is they probably went to Hunter beforehand and said, make sure your dad protects us and we'll keep our mouths shut. That didn't happen. My hunch about the timing of this is that they're talking to Peter Schweizer and other people, confirming what's on emails, confirming what's on text, confirming the modus operandi. Peter Schweizer both wrote a book about some of these issues, and there's a documentary on YouTube done by Blaze TV that people can look up about Biden and the Chinese secrets involving China in particular. Peter Schweizer did Clinton Cash. He's also documented corruption on both sides of the political aisle over the past 20 years. Very good independent investigative old school journalist. He does it with documents. He does it with evidence. He prepares it like I would prepare it or you would prepare it going into court. So there's definite evidence of extensive Biden corruption. And the question is, can they keep a seal on it better than they kept a seal on the Clinton emails and Clinton Cash scandal of 2016?
Okay. All right. And so that's getting back to the substance of what is going to come out, because I suspect we haven't seen the tip of the iceberg yet. No. But everyone's asking, how can these social media platforms censor with impunity? Which I guess in a way it brings us into the section 230. You know, the long lead up to that was they all knew it was coming. They were ready for this. And I guess, you know, they knew where to block it and how to block it. They have the ability to suspend accounts left, right and center, which they were doing. Anybody who shared the story. Actually, funny thing, which might explain why, I forget which lawmaker it was who asked ACB during the hearing the whole 2-minute hypothetical question about a vice president's son, which I thought was inappropriate during the hearing, but it would be difficult to ban people for sharing that soundbite on Twitter without looking like you're censoring actual government information, which might make you liable. How do they do it with impunity? And at what point are they held to account, and on what basis could they be?
So two things there. Historically, big tech has been planning for this day for a long time, but especially since Trump's rise. So they met on an island outside South Carolina in February of 2016 to brainstorm how to do this. The agreement at that time was that Trump couldn't win the general election, so they weren't going to put their foot on the side either way, and so that nobody could accuse them of it. But they wanted to be in a position to do so, and they had been working with the Chinese government to how to leverage their monopolistic controls to suppress and censor information and to track people for a social credit score type system. This started getting leaked out by dissident members of Google, dissident members of Facebook over the years. But they still planned on going this route. Now, for those further back, like when you're talking with Eric Hunley, who for folks out there does a great podcast, the Unstructured Podcast. You can follow it on YouTube. Did a great interview with Viva last week. He does great interviews with those behavior panel people that are just
and he did a great interview with John McAfee,
I'll explain why John McAfee is assuredly innocent, but I'll explain that a little bit later.
No, we're getting there.
Exactly. But back to the true corruption of Section 2 of big tech and how Section 230 has been misused. So they put that in practical motion then. Going all the way back though to that question that was on the Eric Hunley, an Unstructured show. It is true that the internet was originally created by DARPA, the defense industry, in order to have secure communication. And then it became used for privatized purposes in the late 80s, early 90s. A great, I think it's Hold and Catch Fire or something like that. It's a great TV series that basically does a dramatic cinematic narration of the whole big tech revolution from 1985 through 2000. It even has basically a McAfee component, though it's a different character. It's basically that component. And it tells it well through these different stories and tells it really well. I think it's Hold and Catch Fire or something like that. I'll find the link and put it in the comments in the description below. So effectively, it went from the original assumption was that they were going to gather information, not censor and suppress, because the intelligence agencies didn't want them to do that. This was an exceptional means of tracking people. This is why, like, people are shocked that there's these huge voter files on them that predict what they're going to do. And they're like, that can't possibly be true. They don't realize that everything about your life has been digitized and monetized for some other company to have on you. You give me your name, I can basically pretty quickly figure out what newspapers you subscribe to, what you like on Facebook, what you comment on Twitter, what your voting history is, what your property holding history is, who lives at your home, what church you donate to, what school you go. I mean, you name it. I mean, just a wide range of activities that become pretty effective at some point of forecasting who you are. I know because I sort of tested this on a personal basis just to see how well they could advertise to me on Instagram by liking things I like. And it's like freaky how good they are. They like come up with stuff that I'm like, wow, that's fascinating. Wow, that's fascinating too. And I'm like, man, these guys are good at this. So that's how good the algorithm is. The Facebook joke is, if you like 5 things, Facebook knows you as well as a distant relative. If you like 10 things, Facebook knows you as well as a friend. If you like 20 things on Facebook, Facebook knows you as well as a family member. And if you liked 50 things on Facebook, they know you better than your spouse does. That's the Facebook sort of mantra. The whole goal was the demonetization of your private information. Now, censorship doesn't fit into that. So the intelligence apparatus in the United States originally did not want the big tech involved in censorship. And when they passed the Communities Decency Act, Communications Decency Act in the mid-1990s, the Section 230 that was part of it, the whole goal was we want America to win the big tech race. So we're going to immunize you so that you can't get sued as long as you're acting in good faith and you're acting as a platform, not a publisher, so on and so forth. But it never anticipated, because the backstory that everybody on Congress and the Hill knew was that the goal was to gather massive information on people, which is useless if they're censoring, because then they're driving people underground. So they never thought that would happen. What changed was 2008, Obama wins. He wins heavily thanks to big tech. There's news stories about how big tech was working with his campaign secretly behind the scenes, because big tech has so much information on what people are thinking, what people are motivated by. Their algorithms are incredibly accurate at understanding what's likely to occur. They always thought it would work that way, because it worked that way in 2012. Then all of a sudden Trump comes along. They think it's just an anomaly. When Trump wins, they're shocked. Soros is enraged. He starts shorting big tech stock, starts asking Congress to open up investigations to accuse them of enabling foreign interference. So they're getting pressure from that side, and they're getting pressure internally, because their entire professional class of engineers and lawyers and staffers are all to the progressive social justice warrior left. It's the reason why Joe Rogan is currently having problems at Spotify. There's an internal revolution at Spotify against allowing the most popular podcaster in the world to have on who he wants to have on and broadcast what he wants to broadcast. So which means Spotify lied to the world, by the way. If they don't fix that, the big lawsuit's coming to Spotify, because they made billions of dollars promising that they were going to have an uncensored Joe Rogan on. Well, and that's why their stock went up.
I suspect they will have inducement problems with Joe Rogan if he's not going there, so that he can meet more censorship than he's leaving and presumably verify this information before moving. Continue.
So that's the backstory to what's happened. The legal pretext was Section 230. Now, I was on Jordan Belfort's show last week. I think he's going to publish it, in the next week or two. For folks who don't know, that's the man that Leonardo DiCaprio played in the movie The Wolf of Wall Street. Fascinating guy, brilliant salesman. I mean, truly brilliant salesman. That guy could sell ice to an Eskimo, as the old saying goes. As I explained to him, I have had good fortune in my life to represent a lot of innocent clients. And if I had represented him, he would have been innocent too. I forgot until he brought up, he said, Section 230 is all about me. And I was like, what? And he was like, exactly. I had not put two together.
I've got to say, I'm ashamed. I might get haters. I've never seen The Wolf of Wall Street, but I know everything about it. I've read the synopsis. I've just never actually been able to sit down for 3 hours to watch the movie.
it's Scorsese, in my view, Scorsese's best movie. Basically, he's describing what he does brilliantly cinematically is describe how easy the trap and the destruction of depravity can be. That once you get into a certain lifestyle, it can slowly consume you. It's initially seductive, but ultimately destructive, which is actually Belfort's main theory and theme about his own life and his redemption story. I would have had more of his redemption story in the movie. That's the only difference. But because he's amazingly managed to do that. Fascinating guy. And just pure, he's like Scott Adams level persuasion analysis. So I recommend it for anybody to go to his sales school and whatnot. And he still has to give back money to the people. It was funny. You sit there and tell me, he's like, yeah. So, I realized then. So for folks who don't know, Stratton Oakmont sued Prodigy. And for those of us young, old enough to remember, I mean, that was big back then, AOL and all that jazz. In 1995, because on the boards, they were accusing Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street, of being involved in fraud. And Belfort laughed. He said, I sued and had a great suit against him. He said, of course, what people were saying was actually true, but we had a defamation claim at the time. So basically people were outing him. It went up to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit said Prodigy is not immune. I always knew it as the Prodigy suit. That's how I remembered. But then when he mentioned it, I was like, oh, yeah, Stratton Oakmont. So it was actually his company. A senator read the story about that and was so enraged that the senator demanded a change in the law so that guys like Jordan Belfort could not sue a company like Prodigy for what someone actually outed him for doing on board. So that's how Section 230 gets initiated. Now, what happens afterwards is that the courts interpret Section 230 to be a blanket immunity for big tech across the board.
And actually, just to put a pause in there, there were two, I forget the name of the other decision now, I'm going to forget, I think it was CompuServe, where there were two decisions which were sort of similar at the time. Prodigy, where Prodigy actually made an effort to moderate some of the content on their website, and because they didn't remove this defamatory article, notwithstanding the fact that they said they do moderate, they were held liable. This other one, CompuServe, said, we don't make any attempts to moderate any of the content, and so whatever's on there is not our problem, none of our business, and they, under similar circumstances but not identical, were not found liable. And so, the idea was then that you're actually penalizing people who are trying to do the right thing and letting off the hook those who are not even making an attempt, and that was the underlying reason to say, under Section 230, if you try to create guidelines and try to bring off illegal content, you won't be held liable if you don't, if something slips through the cracks. And nor will you be held, nor can you be held liable for attempting to enforce it and ensure that illegal content does not end up on the platform that you are offering. And at the time, I think it was illegal content, not offensive content in the sense that anybody's using it now in YouTube. So that was part of the backdrop was, Section 230 was an attempt to uniformize or, you know, make logical what a principle that didn't seem logical at the time was, if you make an attempt, you'll be held liable. If you don't make any attempt and you leave all the crap up, you won't be held liable.
Exactly. Yeah, so there were two, back then the idea was, if you exercise editorial privileges in a First Amendment conforming manner, they didn't use that language, but if you look at the substantive provisions they're talking about, they're saying you make a good faith effort to moderate, to exclude, and they list a bunch of categories. They're describing things that are unprotected by the First Amendment, violent conduct, but they even then they say extremely violent conduct, harassing conduct, stalking conduct, certain kinds of pornography, et cetera. And they provide for certain protections and take them out and put them in. But what happened is the courts interpreted it as, hey, Congress is telling us they want big tech protected for political reasons, economic reasons. So we're going to protect them across the board. And the way that expanded, first, it started out a slow expansion. The second way was I've been debating a bunch of big tech professors. Well, purportedly professors, law professors, think tank people for the last 5 years on this. And they always attack me and they say there's no such thing as a publisher, platform distinction, da, da, da. What happened is Google and the rest bought up all the think tanks and many of the professors. What a lot of these law professors don't disclose is who is donating to their foundation at their law school or donating or that they're a private consultant for on the side. There was no money on the side of the people wanting to control big tech, tons of money on the side of big tech. So they bought off the reason, your reasons. The reason why Robbie Sove, I think it's Robbie Sove, talking about, the reason why he's commenting on that, he works for Reason. Reason is heavily influenced by the Koch Foundation. The Kochs are on the big tech side. And that's why Reason, aside from, pretending that Judge Barrett is going to be a great civil rights advocate on the Supreme Court, is pretending that is mad about this issue because they don't want big tech to be controlled or censored because they're in big tech's pocket. That's why the leading libertarian foundations are in big tech's pocket. Almost the entire law school, almost every lawyer or law professor that's blogging on this is in big tech's pocket. And that's why what the judges saw was, hey, all the legal academy and experts agree that Section 230 was really meant to just immunize everything. And so I came up with two lines of attack about 4 years ago. One line was to try the constitutional route, which was the old argument following a line of decisions from both California and the United States Supreme Court that said when a private company chooses to monopolize part of the public square, they're bound by the First Amendment. It became very clear that line of suits had zero chance.
And it's interesting. I've been following this long enough to have seen that trajectory. PragerU didn't get away with it. Tulsi get away with it. It made no headway with PragerU. It made no headway with Tulsi Gabbard. And it became clear they're not going to accept that argument. They're not. They're private enterprises. They are not town square. They are not corporate cities. So it's not going to go anywhere. And it didn't go anywhere, right. Which is when people have to think about a second line of attack.
I still think it should, but that's different from the reality that it ain't. So I compare it to Indian treaties. They look good on paper, but good luck when the cavalry comes. So this is the reality of situation of that aspect of that argument. I think theoretically, conceptually, I still stand by my position because I think for all those who are like, well, what about some little company that's now going to be thrown out of business because they have to regulate? No, this only would apply if you have monopoly power. You have to have at least 75 to 80%. That's the historical metric under antitrust laws of that market space. Google has that in its space, both YouTube and Google search. Facebook has that of its space. Twitter has that of its space. And my view is once you leverage that degree of power and what you're doing is the public square, you should be bound by the First Amendment. But folks, it ain't flying. It ain't going anywhere. It's dead. And it's especially dead after what Justice Thomas wrote, because what Justice Thomas made, he didn't go down that road at all. So that means that road is closed. Now, the second road I was trying to go down was to resuscitate common law theories of civil liability and say that just because you're big tech doesn't mean you shouldn't be held to the same standards of contracts and torts as every other mom and pop company in the world. So if you make a promise to somebody, you have to keep it. If you get unjustly enriched, you got to return it. If you are violating people's consumer principles or assumptions or expectations, you can be held liable under Consumer Practices Act laws. Unfortunately, that too has been shut off until what Justice Thomas wrote. And because I figured that would be the second path to solution, because all of these companies have lied to induce their monopoly power. I also think antitrust laws, I agree with Matt Stoller and others, need to be resuscitated against these companies because they've clearly leveraged the argument in the various suits that are being brought against them now, the antitrust investigation, they're under state attorney generals, U.S. Department of Justice, are all very legitimate and justified because they've leveraged their antitrust power to increase their power over another sector of the economy. And that's what antitrust law prohibits. But putting that aside for the moment, the other claims should all be because they promised things. I mean, Twitter said we're going to be the free speech wing of the free speech party. They did so to induce people to monetize their information, their connections, their associations, which made Twitter rich, gave all of Twitter's money, came from that activity, and then turned around and broke the promise to be the free speech wing of the free speech party.
And you know what? I've got to mention it. Like Jack comes out at the beginning of when this election cycle started and says, we're not taking any campaign ads or political ads on our platform. We're going to remain neutral and not, I think you remain neutral. And then some people were asking this question, is what they did not a contribution in kind to the campaign to censor, negative material? It was sort of actually a tongue in cheek question, but is what they did cannot be considered to be anything tangible in terms of donation.
If you use the democratic standards, it is a violation. Now, my view is there's a lot of First Amendment restrictions on those campaign finance laws. So I'm not in favor of a broad interpretation of those laws because the probability they get interpreted in a way that favors ordinary people against the elite ain't high. So so that's my view. When they said Donald Trump Jr. had a meeting and received information from a foreign source, I was like, that's hogwash. That's all First Amendment protected activity. So and I feel the same here, that it's probably First Amendment protected activity. Unless one exception, if you're explicitly coordinating with the campaign, then that's considered a campaign donation. And that and the value of what they did way exceeds what they can legally contribute.
Now,
an FEC complaint would be valid.
Okay, now that's very interesting because if there is not an FEC complaint yet, Congress is talking about congressional subpoenas, which might, assuming nobody's deleted emails because they haven't received a subpoena yet, might evidence coordination. We'll see. No point hypothesizing on that. But actually, sorry, we got off the topic. Justice Thomas releases that 10-page opinion. My first question in that. Oh, you want to add something first?
No, go ahead. Okay.
My first question with Justice Thomas's opinion is how and why? Because we're sitting there watching Amy Coney Barrett all week talk about how I'm not giving opinions on hypotheticals unless there's a court file, a briefed file. We don't want to indicate how we're going to adjudicate on things. And then with, you know, and then out of the blue, for no good reason, in denying a petition for writ of certiorari, Justice Thomas issues a 10-page advisory opinion, unsolicited opinion, nonetheless. So why did he do it? How did he do it? And was it wrong to do it in the first place?
So about 5 years ago or so, give or take, I and some other lawyers came up with this idea of these two paths attacks, and they mimicked my lawsuits in a range of cases across the country. And initially actually prevailed in a San Francisco trial court, and then Court of Appeals in California, of course, stepped in very quickly and reversed. But it showed the possibilities, because what we did is we looked at every single theory of attack, which ones had had any chance of success, and we found that some commercial attacks had worked, but not for ordinary consumers, just for, and I was like, well, logically it would extend. So a lot of those cases, they have brought up to the Supreme Court, and the petitions were not granted, but it's one of the reasons why I tell people, whenever you have a chance to file something to the U.S. Supreme Court, do it. Doesn't matter if your chance is 1 in 1,000. So that's why I'll file 3 or 4 this year, at least have filed dozens over the years, even though it's expensive. It's like $5,000 just to print their little, you have to print a little thing that's like 9 copies of it and a special little, leave it to the Supreme Court. Always have to print something special. Can't just do something normal. But it's worth it because they read all of those, and at least they're in their clerks often read them. So if you keep hammering away at them, even if they don't take your case, you're going to start to see justices say, hold on a second. It's also why you argue in the court of public opinion. You keep hammering and hammering and hammering a thematic structure so that because every, as Sullivan eminently reveals on the bad side of the aisle, judges pay a lot of attention to what's going on in the court of public opinion. So the so that's why it's important to do so. It's also important sometimes to keep your mouth shut too. So it depends on the case. So that's why it was good. And I think Thomas had seen those and he borrowed the second line. So he's like, first line's not going anywhere, making it constitutional, making him a quasi-government. That's just not working. It's not likely to work with my colleagues. Drop it. And what he's doing is the reason why he issued it is he's giving a roadmap for everybody out there. He's saying, hey, the second road is viable. I, as a Supreme Court justice, think it's viable. You can now cite it to every court in the country, state court, federal court in the country. I'll be the only Supreme Court opinion on the subject at this point that says, here's why this logic and this path should actually reform what happened. Because his point is, this was never intended. There's been a big lie told by the legal academy that's in the pocket of big tech. That this was intended to be a blanket carte blanche immunity. No, it wasn't. These companies got rich by lying to their consumers, lying to them about what they were going to do. Nobody would have joined Facebook rather than MySpace if Facebook would have said, by the way, in the future, we will randomly censor your content. We will randomly manipulate your algorithm and we'll monetize your private information, including your kids' private information, for our personal profit. Would people have gone to Facebook then and said, no, there would be no big Facebook. MySpace would have dominated. Twitter similarly would have lost. YouTube similarly would have lost. Google similarly would have lost. YouTube makes its money off of its contents, if its creators' content. YouTube does nothing but provide a platform for it. If how many people would have joined YouTube rather than any of the other competitors 10 years ago, if YouTube would have said, by the way, we'll randomly cut off your monetization, we'll randomly use the algorithms to drive down searches for your content, or maybe we'll just overnight destroy your accounts like we did last week to anybody who mentioned certain Biden information, or to a whole bunch of QAnon accounts. And I've been very public about not being a fan of QAnon theories and strategies. I am a harsh critic of any effort to censor them.
It's an amazing thing, actually, just to highlight the injustice. Even when they demonetize a video because the video itself is inappropriate, that content creator is still driving people to the platform, driving them to other videos, which themselves are monetized. It is patently a case of enrichment or unjust enrichment. Unjust.
Absolutely.
So now I just...
So what Thomas did is he laid out, and you did a good video on it. Thomas lays out, hey, by the way, this is a viable path. This section 230 was never meant to be this broadly expanded. In fact, it's a contradictory reading of the statute. You can't read the whole statute and come up with the interpretation all these courts have come up with, and that this has been bad logic adopted by the lower courts. And I think we should, as a Supreme Court, make it clear. But what he's hoping is district courts pick up on it, courts of appeals pick up on it, state courts pick up on it, so that it starts to breach the impregnable wall of section 230, so that what I argued in court, and I picked a case where I had a Republican judge, a Republican jury. She still shut me down. I ended up getting a good settlement from Twitter just because Twitter didn't want me to appeal it all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court because I was making arguments they didn't realize the resonance of until even the judge recognized them. But the judge was like, hey, politically, there's too much power behind what the – what Justice Thomas did was it was change the power equation. All the power had been on the side of big tech so that every judge who even think about challenging was like, I can't find a single opinion that says you're right, Mr. Barnes. They all say you're wrong. Why am I going to be the one to buck them? Now I have Justice Thomas saying, the only Supreme Court justice to comment on it, saying I'm right. So that means that there's been massive violation of consumers' rights and content creators' rights, and maybe systematic and systemic election law violations, though that has limited legal remedy to the FEC. But the other two should be actionable. There has been massive unjust enrichment by all of them. They got rich by lying to people.
It's an amazing thing. People in Canada, we have the criteria for unjust enrichment, which is enrichment, correlative impoverishment, and an absence of any contractual reason for that to exist. In this case, it's like it's beyond that. It's almost false inducements, like you say. Nobody would have gotten on YouTube, the free speech platform, put up your content so they can build their brand, build the entire platform. But if they don't like your stuff for political or ideological reasons, just demonetize it, shut you down, shut your account down. But the one thing is, Justice Thomas did not. There's nothing unethical about the opinion that he issued.
Oh, no, not at all. So justices do this all the time. So now Thomas actually has a longer history of doing it, though sporadically. I took a Fifth Amendment case to challenge the scope and scale of the meaning of the self-incrimination clause because Justice Thomas and Scalia had joined. And Scalia used to do this. Ginsburg on occasion would do it. Back in the old days, the great jurists like Black and Douglas would frequently do it. So it was just a way of sending a signal and sending a message. So you'll often see these quote-unquote concurring opinions. Remember, Roberts wrote a concurring opinion on the church case on the pandemic, giving a roadmap.
A concurring opinion with an existing opinion, I can understand, but when they're just dismissing a petition for writ of certiorari or cert, they're saying we're not hearing it, but here's what I think on the non-substance of a case that doesn't exist before me. I was just wondering if it was not tantamount to giving an opinion on a non-existent hypothetical case. But
no, because it's the reason they used to actually publish more dissents and concurrences on cert petitions. So there used to be more explanation of why they didn't take a case but would take a future case, why they didn't take a case, things of that nature. So there used to be more of that. About 20 years ago, they started, like it used to be the protocol that Supreme Court justices had complete carte blanche over their circuit. So for those who don't know, each of the Supreme Court justices are assigned circuits. Now, there used to only be 9. Now there's more. So a justice will have more than one circuit. But they used to write their own opinions. They used to write their own bail decisions, which was fantastic back in the day. Now they have a custom and protocol that they refer it to the whole court, which I think is a wuss move. I think they should be writing independent decisions because they get to. And so injunctions, for example, would be decided by the single justice assigned that circuit. I think that's great. I think that's fantastic. I think that we would have more diversity of opinion. What is they didn't want a conflict. So so consequently, they agreed by consent to basically be lazy and have to make the whole court write one. And then all that did is reduce the number of opinions being written each year. But technically, what he did has no problem whatsoever. It's a live case in controversy when the petition for cert's been filed. Now, if he'd written an opinion about something when no petition for cert was filed, that would be problematic.
Okay.
But once it was a live case in front of him, so he could say anything he wanted, even though they were denying the cert.
And by and large, all he did was summarize the history, summarize the case law, and indicate to some extent his interpretation of what the intent was versus how the courts are interpreting it. And obviously the case they had before them was a very unique case because it relied on a separate section of Section 230 and immunity was denied in that case. So it's sort of really not the best case to set the example, but clearly was the roadwork or the roadmap for a future case and what they would have to argue to get up there and to make a point. My question was, I think I know the way I feel my answer. I'm curious to know your thoughts. Is what Twitter and Facebook did not election interference? And if it isn't, why isn't it? Is anybody going to do anything about it?
Two things with that. There's election interference as an objective empirical reality, and then there's election interference as some form of illegality. It's not probably election interference as some form of illegality unless there's been coordination and it's an in-kind campaign to no donation that's been undisclosed in an excess of the limits. I'm not a fan of trying to make a quote-unquote election interference criminal, because at some point you start to criminalize speech. And so that's my concern with that. So to me, the key is factually, now as an objective matter, they're absolutely trying to impact the election. So it's a form of election interference. And to the degree that people describe or define intellectual interference as A, trying to influence an election, and B, doing so by deceptive means, this clearly fits that category. So it's empirically and objectively election interference. That's just not criminal for good reason, because of the First Amendment constitutional constraint that cabins the limit, the application of that law, unless it's deliberately coordinated and basically an in-kind donation that's undisclosed in an excess of the limits. Okay. Now, I do think that what they did is going to empower its critics. And I think it also, by the way, it tells me something politically, which I'll comment on in the more detail in the People's Pundit Daily Show each Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern time. But they would not have taken this gamble if they thought Trump was a lock to lose, because they knew doing this would blow up in their faces. They knew they would get massive criticism and massive blowback. And yet they did it anyway, which, by the way, tells you how true it is. Because if they really thought a detailed inquiry would show that these were bad journalistic methods that showed that there was no verity or validity to this, then they let it take its own path and say, oh, see, this is another crazy fake news story from the critics of Biden's critics. Instead, they were paranoid of anybody paying any attention to this, tried to suppress it and censored it, and considered it more risky for the truth of the story to be revealed than for the truth of their censorship to be known.
I mean, the censorship just, it made no sense. We're not idiots. It comes out without any explanation. The explanation is an ever moving target of personal information, hacked information, false information, all of which are basically mutually exclusive explanations. Okay, so I mean, I think we've covered that. I mean, it's interesting. So the 230 issues that that Clarence Thomas raised now gives a roadmap to how people can attack 230, hopefully have the court set the right precedent, failing which it was Suave's criticism as well. By the way, is Reason left or right, for someone who doesn't know?
It's libertarian, and I call it the mouthpiece of the Koch brothers, but okay. That's my version of it.
So Suave's criticism was that this is just going to empower the wrong people regardless. And it's just
it's going to empower people like me. So we have our specific disagreements on this, and he's right, because I had sort of said, okay, for now, until there's been legislative reform, it's a waste of time to file suit. What Justice Thomas said, combined with what they did last week, says that, hey, maybe I'll get a judge to hear this particular kind of challenge. So I'll try to find the right fact pattern, right case to bring, and I will probably bring a case or two in the forthcoming future on this subject.
Okay. I mean, I don't think we're going to get into more detail on this for the time being. We'll see where Section 230 goes. Say it one more time, your proposal to remedy the deficiencies with Section 230. What could be the easy fix?
Let big tech be held to the same rules as every mom and pop company in the country. When they lie to people, they get held responsible. When they're unjustly enriched, they get held responsible. When they falsely induce people into contracts to create content for them and then screw them over, they get to be held responsible like any other business. So just hold them to the same rules as everybody else.
Excellent. What do we talk? Oh, you know, before we get into the next topic, I just want to read three super chats that I think I may have missed. Andrew Torba, I'm going to be ignorant. Someone said we should do a stream. I'm going to have to educate myself as to who you are. The reason why Trump won't trust big tech is because big tech stocks are a huge percentage of my stock portfolio. Trust busts big tech monopolies. Stock market be damned. Also getgab.com. Craig Lino, 504, says, is Congress totally bought by big tech? What laws can be passed to stop big tech from censorship? So we got that as well.
Yeah, you know, just make clear what Justice Thomas said about Section 230, allow them to be sued. And my additional component is to say that Section 230 is conditioned on them applying First Amendment standards and how they govern their platforms, so that if they want the carrot of any kind of immunity, they have to provide the stick of enforcing First Amendment standards on their platform.